I am just laying eyes here on the winners of the 2015 East Lansing Community Photo Contest, sponsored by the City of East Lansing and co-sponsored by Meyer and the East Lansing Downtown Management Board. I'm only able to see thumbnails of this on my Facebook page here, but just with that in mind, some of these are really impressive pieces of work. I'm looking at about 9 thumbnail photographs, and all of them apparently winners in the photo contest. I'd urge you to go to the City of East Lansing Facebook page and check them out for yourself. Really colorful, a number of aerial views of, looks like we've got a Spartan basketball game in there. We got a great shot of the Broad. Really good stuff. So congratulations to all the winners in the City of East Lansing photo contest there. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is Tuesday. This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A large and influential Michigan farmers organization is suing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The Michigan Farm Bureau, which represents nearly 50,000 farmers across the state, says the EPA's recent Waters of the U.S. rule is a federal power grab. The intent of the rule is to allow authorities to keep a closer eye on smaller, more local water features that connect to and possibly threaten larger ones that are already covered by the U.S. Clean Water Act. The Farm Bureau joins a number of states and industry groups suing the EPA over the rule. Yesterday afternoon, I spoke with Laura Campbell, the manager of the Michigan Farm Bureau's Agricultural Ecology Department. I first asked her to describe what the organization calls absurd regulations and how they hurt farmers.
The EPA has said under this rule that they can go not only to your traditional navigable waters that everybody agrees ought to be under federal regulation, but also anything that they choose to define as a tributary, which doesn't even have to have water in it in order to be regulated. And then on top of that, any water features that may or may not be connected up to 1,500 feet away from those tributaries and those other regulated waters. In a state like Michigan, we're looking at virtually every bit of water that's on the ground being federally regulated, requiring permits for a lot of different activities, including application of nutrients, managing pests, moving earth around when you have to do your normal farming activities. A lot of those things, the exemptions that were written into the Clean Water Act don't apply. And so our farmers are looking at being very heavily regulated across the entire state under this new rule.
Well, help us understand, though, because I know the EPA says that exemptions for agricultural activities will remain the same under this new rule. In fact, they say the new rule actually expands exemptions for farmers. How will these new regulations impact farmers any differently than the current ones if those exemptions remain?
Well, the exemptions that exist for farming activities are for what EPA has defined as normal farming activities. So plowing, planting, cultivating, harvesting, just your basic stuff. What they don't cover, those exemptions don't cover, are application of nutrients, application of any kind of pest management strategy, and anything that, as they call it, changes the reach or flow of a regulated water. So if you're moving earth around, even under your normal plowing regime, and you change the reach or flow of one of these newly regulated waters, that is, you've disturbed what EPA is all of a sudden going to call a tributary, which is really just, where water happens to channel and flow through your farm during a heavy rainstorm. Now, all of a sudden, you're caught up under a federal regulatory scheme that you don't get an exemption for. Mm. So while it's technically true, we didn't lose any exemptions under this new rule, the exemptions are so limited that they don't really help us.
Laura Campbell is manager of the Agricultural Ecology Department for the Michigan Farm Bureau. We're talking about the lawsuit the Farm Bureau announced yesterday against the Waters of the U.S. rule from the EPA. Clarify for us here. I mean, you've said that the new rule is too broad and too vague. Isn't it true the rule does explicitly exclude certain water features, including puddles and groundwater and erosional features?
Sure, sure. I mean, the rule does lay out specifically that there are certain features across the landscape that are not regulated. Although the fact that they have to explicitly exclude puddles ought to give you a pretty good idea of exactly how far-reaching these regulations are. The regulations and what's not regulated are very, very limited. So, for instance, EPA has said, "Hey, we gave you a lot of things. We said that certain classes of ditches are not going to be regulated under this new rule." Well, the only ditches that are exempt under this new rule are ditches that don't flow all the time and those which a farmer can prove were not dug out of or changing the flow of a previously existing stream. Now, a lot of Michigan's drainage system was built 80 to 100 to 150 years ago. A lot of that proof is gone. And where drainage tends to be built is where the low spots are, where that water tends to naturally flow. Some of the other things, groundwater that they've talked about has never been regulated. That's never been a question. And I don't think that anybody's trying to say that we're claiming that it is. But, you know, just the idea of how many things across the landscape are included in this new regulation or could be interpreted to be included in this regulation is very concerning to us. We got a report actually from our counterparts down in Tennessee Farm Bureau. EPA Region 4 had done a jurisdictional determination of a farm down there. They took what was clearly to everyone that you can show the picture of, and I'm almost sorry that this is radio that we can't show the picture. It's on our website if anyone wants to go check it out, that you can clearly see this is an erosional feature across the middle of a cornfield. EPA came out and the U.S. Army Corps for that district down there and said, nope, that is a tributary. It has a bed bank and ordinary high water mark. Therefore, it is federally regulated. And those are the kinds of things that really scare our farmers.
I know some farmers are also worried the rule will require a pretty bureaucratic permitting process to obtain and use water for a variety of purposes. What would be required exactly that concerns you?
Well, for most states, and Michigan doesn't happen to be included, at least not right now, because we work directly with our state agencies for most of our permitting purposes. But for most of the country, when you have to go and get a permit from the U.S. Army Corps or from EPA, they have no time limits as to when they have to answer a permit, so they can sit on it for months or years, and in the meantime, you can't operate or do the activities that you need to be able to do because you don't even have an answer to your permit. The permits themselves can be very expensive. They can require very expensive replacement or mitigation of any kind of wetlands that EPA has decided might be disturbed by your activity. And the penalties for violating the Clean Water Act, if you either because you don't know or because, you know, there's some circumstance that causes you to do an activity out there, can run into tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they can include jail time.
Now, as part of the rulemaking process, let's get back into some of these smaller water features. As part
Sure.
of the rulemaking process, I know the EPA did extensive research into how major bodies of water are connected to some of these smaller water features like streams or wetlands. Are you disputing the scientific reasoning for the rule?
What the basis of our dispute is not necessarily about where water ought to be controlled at some point. The basis of a lot of our dispute tends to come down to what ought to be regulated by the federal government versus what ought to be managed by the states. This is very much a federalism argument, not so much a clean water argument. Everybody wants clean water, including farmers, because we live on the landscape that we farm. This is very much more about if these tiny features up on the landscape, which may or may not have significant connection, and that's what it all comes down to, is trying to form a scientific definition out of a legal term, significant nexus. If they do or do not have a significant nexus, where's the dividing point? Where should a state manage its waters versus where should the federal government step in and declare, no, these are now under the purview of the Clean Water Act and all of the, you know, regulatory burden and criminal penalties and, you know, heavy expenses start to apply.
We're talking with Laura Campbell here on Current State. Laura is the manager of the Agricultural Ecology Department for the Michigan Farm Bureau. We're talking about the Farm Bureau's lawsuit announced yesterday against the EPA involving its Waters of the U.S. rule. What's the ultimate goal of the lawsuit? Is it revisions, Laura? Is it getting it scrapped altogether? What?
Really, our analysis of the Waters of the U.S. rule is that it is too broken to be fixed. You know, there's been a lot of talk, I think, among different regulatory groups. Well, what could we do? Could we make these modifications? In our opinion, it really needs to be pulled back altogether and the process started over again with actual meaningful input from states, from stakeholders, from agricultural groups, business owners, landowners, the people who are going to be affected by that regulation. We really felt, even though there was that public comment period, we really felt very much like our voices were not heard by EPA.
Well, the final rule did take into account, from what I'm led to believe, around 1 million comments from the public and other stakeholders. Environmentalists claim that the vast majority of those, around 87%, were in favor of the rule. Do you fear that public opinion and the agriculture industry are at odds here?
Well, I think that there are very effective ways to get people to click a button and say, well, of course I support clean water. You know, doesn't everybody support clean water? There, I believe, is still an ongoing investigation as to whether or not EPA had, you know, improper involvement with the advocacy for the development of this rule. And, you know, we'll be looking forward to seeing how that comes out, you know, as to whether or not a federal agency should get involved in advocating for its own proposed rule. But nevertheless, I mean, I think really, like I said, this issue is not about clean water. So if you try to make it about clean water, of course people support that. Everyone wants clean water to drink, to swim in, to support our natural environment. What our problem is with the details of this rule, with the extension and overreach of federal control versus what ought to be controlled at the local and state level. And that's where the argument starts breaking down.
Environmentalists also say the new rule is a way of just closing loopholes after two Supreme Court cases back in the 2000s muddied the water, so to speak, on the EPA's jurisdiction. They say the new rule is just clarifying authority that EPA already has under the Clean Water Act. How do you respond to that claim?
Well, I would say that the Supreme Court knew quite a bit of what it was doing in the last two, and you could even argue back to three court cases that have been decided, all of which have been in the Great Lakes Basin, over what the limits should be to EPA jurisdiction. And in those cases, the Supreme Court has spoken, you know, perhaps not in as clear a way as we would like, but certainly they've spoken definitively to say there are limits to EPA's jurisdictional capabilities. And the fact that they keep issuing rules and proposing regulations that stretch beyond those bounds and then have to be pulled back by the courts, you know, tells us that this is an ongoing issue of EPA not really understanding the congressional intent behind the Clean Water Act, that it's based in interstate commerce, that it is designed to help the states manage their own waters by taking jurisdiction over those waters that influence, you know, multiple states and even in our national boundaries and certainly our international boundary with our neighbors. And not to be micromanaging and regulating tiny little water features up across the landscape, you know, especially when Michigan farmers in particular feel like they've been working very hard through a lot of different programs to be very protective of those water resources. We've got the Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program that's got 10,000 farmers started through that program. We've got 3,000 verifications done already. I mean, that's stopped over 2 million tons of sediment from entering Michigan waterways just since it was put into place in 2011.
A recent decision from the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati temporarily blocked this regulation from taking effect, but it did not come down one way or the other on the legality of the new rule. Are you optimistic that the new rule will be struck down?
I don't want to make any predictions to that. I definitely want to leave that to the legal experts, but we appreciate being able to have the chance to have our voice heard, and that's part of why we filed this suit in the first place. Is, you know, lawyers can, you know, can get out and talk and make legal arguments and you know, confuse people all day long. But when a farmer stands up and says, I'm trying to run a business, I'm trying to do things right, and this regulation is preventing me from being able to even farm, let alone try to do things right, I think that's a much more powerful message, and that's what we're concentrating on.
The Michigan Farm Bureau has filed suit against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency over its Waters of the U.S. rule. Laura Campbell of the Farm Bureau has been our guest. She's the manager of agricultural ecology for MFB. Laura, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Current state, three times every weekday on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, every day at noon on AM 870, always at WKAR.org. Art lovers have lots of options in the Lansing area, from the Broad Art Museum at MSU to the Lansing Art Gallery to public works of art. Now there's an easy way to explore art that you may have never seen around town. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on a new smartphone app called 517 Art Search. How does it work, Scott?
Well, Mark, it's really simple. You download the app, you open it up on your phone, and you let it find artworks for you. I talked with Debbie McCula of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing and Matt Penniman of Message Makers in Old Town Lansing about 517 Art Search, and we even took it for a spin.
You know, this came out of a long-range planning session of the Arts Council about 2 years ago, and we started talking about how do we recognize all of the public art in the Tri-Counties, and we just started to brainstorm, and we sat around the table, and we thought, boy, you know, mobile application is really, you know, coming out of the door at that point, and that was the way that we really wanted to start to document. We've seen, we saw a few models across the nation. We weren't really happy with any of those, and we wanted to make sure that we saw all of the public art, almost 200 pieces of public art, in one location so that we knew what the impact really is about what has taken place in our community.
One thing I want to quickly follow up on is you mentioned the Tri-Counties, and I think people might not understand why you care about anything outside Ingham County. It's because it's what you cover here at the Arts Council, right?
Yeah, we're the, you know, our mission is to work within the capital region, which we consider Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties. And there is a lot to be said about, while we do most of our work in the urban core of Lansing and East Lansing, you know, we're looking at rural communities out in some of those other areas, and we want to make sure that they look at public art and placemaking in the same context as the Arts Council.
So, Matt Penniman, if I am downloading the app and want to use it, tell me, first of all, what does it do for me?
Well, it shows you public art that's near you. We wanted this app to be useful both for people sitting on their couch at home, browsing through public art that's available, and people out on the go. So wherever you are, when you open up the app, it'll show you pieces of public art ordered by how far away they are from you at the moment. So you can quickly locate what's near you, read about it, and go find it.
Does it tell me how to get there?
Yes. It'll give you a compass, like that's like a magic compass that points directly to the artwork. So if you turn around with your phone, the compass will keep pointing to the art. You can also trigger a map view so that you can get directions if you're driving.
So do the people at Message Makers routinely create smartphone apps like this? How did this project fit in with what Message Makers typically does?
Well, at Message Makers, we are creators of experiences that transform, so we'll do just about whatever it takes to get a good communications result for our clients. And we've worked with Debbie a lot in the past, and when she had this idea for a mobile app, we saw a great way to take it and run with it.
Debbie, when you unveiled this new app, tell me about the immediate reaction that you got here at the Arts Council.
We unveiled it at the Creative Placemaking Summit, and about 150 artists and arts leaders and municipal leadership and business leadership were there to watch that unveiling and to immediately pick up their phones and download that app.
Were they looking to see if their own artwork was included?
I'm absolutely sure they were. So I think it's really interesting because of the geographic sense of the app, they were trying to figure out what was the closest piece to them. And because of how the GPS works, it tells you within, 100 feet or within, 2 miles, where is the closest piece. And I think they were pretty amazed that there were so many pieces of public art right in the vicinity of where we were.
I would imagine that if an artist or someone who had commissioned public art were to look at the app and discover that their piece wasn't included, that they could get the information to you and get it added. Would that be correct, Matt?
Absolutely. 517artsearch.com is the website for the app, and there's a contact form there, and we can very easily add art pieces to the app. We don't need to revise the app itself. We have a data stream that we can insert pieces very easily.
We're talking with Matt Penniman of Message Makers and Debbie McCullough of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing about the 517 Art Surge app. I'm going to ask one of you to open the app on your phone for me right now.
Okay, so we're going to go to the home screen and we see the little icon, the 517 Art Surge icon, and we open it up. And the first thing we're going to see, once it determines my location, we're going to see the piece of art that is closest. It's not only public art that we're showcasing, it is spaces, art spaces, so galleries, and we're going to be adding theater spaces, and we're going to be adding museums to this. So the first place that shows up is the Arts Council of Greater Lansing, because
right
we're standing right here. But the next piece that is right next door to us is one of the pianos that has Deb Fehrenbach is an artist in the area, and she painted one of the pianos for the Keys of the City project. So we've considered that. The Catalyst Art Gallery, which is two doors down from us, is another space.
And each one, there's a photograph, too, not just its location.
The location of it, and then a small description of the space or the piece of art. And if it's a space, we're talking about what hours are they open and things like that, too. So here's the one that is, again, right next door to us as well, the Sound Junkie. Redhead Design Studio was the artist, and we have a very brief description of what that piece of art, and it is within 0.01 miles of us.
That's really close.
As soon as you get close to it, it will trigger a success page and say, congratulations, you found the artwork. And once you find it, you can then share your success on Facebook and show your friends the public art that you've found. Or go back and see other pieces nearby. So let's take a little walk and see about some artwork that's perhaps a little bit hidden and we might not see it right away. Some of these, like the pianos, are right on the street, so you could see them driving by. But there's a memorial sculpture for Robert Busby down on the river trail that I'd like to go see. It's only 0.11 miles away. So if we tap on that one, we can see a description of who the artist was and who Robert Busby was. And then tap on the compass icon and it'll show us which direction to go to get to it. So let's go take a walk.
So take me there.
No, just follow the compass.
Just follow the compass.
Okay. So it was pointing left, so we knew we had to turn left.
We're on a little walk, and we're heading down Turner Street to where the Robert Busby Memorial is located.
We're going to go through the Cesar Chavez Plaza, aka Lot 56, the big parking lot in Old Town, and that'll take us to the River Trail.
As you walk, is it telling you that you're getting closer?
Yeah. We're now within 0.09 miles. Now 8.
It keeps getting smaller.
We're almost there. So Matt, within about 0.02 miles of being in the vicinity, it kind of tells you that you're there.
Yep.
Okay.
If you followed the app, it would tell you you're there, and yet it might still take a little bit of searching for something that's a little hidden like this memorial is.
Sure. There's kind of a ring of detection around the artwork, so that if your GPS isn't quite on spot, you never have the problem of standing right by it and saying, why doesn't it say I'm there? But here it is. Here's the memorial sculpture.
So let's look at the app. What is it telling me now? It's
so
showing.
So now it shows me a photograph of the piece, and it this is where we can then share our success at finding it through posting on Facebook.
So if you did post it to Facebook, what would your Facebook friends see? I recently visited the Busby Memorial in Old Town Lansing, or something along that line.
Well, they'd see whatever you wrote about it, and they'd see you found it through 517 Art Search, and they'd have a link to the description on 517artsearch.com, so they could read more.
Well, that was simple. It works great.
Yeah. That's the point.
Well done, Matt.
Well, thank you.
I think we wanted to keep it very simple in terms of what it could do. We actually did, maybe you remember, we did a pilot in East Lansing, and we ended up doing some beacon technology, which we were not able to sustain in terms of the costs of that. And when we approached message makers, you know, we talked about the simplicity. This is really pointing people in the direction of finding these beautiful pieces of art that sometimes are hidden. And I think that's really where we looked at how it has to be simple. It has to be based on your geography, so that people actually can go up to these. You can sit on your couch at home and figure this out too, and just have you can go through all 173 pieces of public art and spaces. But we really wanted to get people out of the outside and actually come and visit these.
One final very important question. How much does the app cost?
It's free. Completely free. 100% free. Go try it.
Matt Penniman is a writer and communication strategist at Message Makers in Old Town Lansing. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And Debbie McCullough is Executive Director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, we talked to Great Lakes environmental commentator Gary Wilson about October's biggest environmental stories, including Flint's water crisis and how Canada's recent election could impact the Great Lakes. Plus, for more than 150 years, the iron ore found in northern Michigan has fueled industrial development across the U.S. The mighty ships that transport that ore are the subject of a multimedia exhibit now at the MSU Museum. Current State's Peter Wharf talks with curator and MSU professor John Beck about the display, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters. Stay with us, it's Current State. Time now for a Current State staff music pick. Scott Polds picked a new reggae song that caught his ear.
Listen, darling. Who's gonna hold and squeeze me tight? Now that she's gone, of my life. Who's gonna make me feel the way she used to do? Now that my love is overdue.
The track is titled Love Overdue. Why'd you pick this one, Scott?
Well, Mark, this is Keith Richards from his new solo album, Cross-Eyed Heart. And I like it because while the album has his Rolling Stones-ish guitar throughout, this one may surprise some listeners who aren't aware of his affection for reggae. One of his side projects over the years has been with a reggae group called Wingless Angels.
Love Overdue by Keith Richards. Thanks, Scott.
Sure, Mark.
And now I'm a prisoner of loneliness. Yeah. Then I'm a prisoner.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. From Flint's water crisis to the continued calls for actions on Lake Erie's algae problem, the safety of water in the Great Lakes region has taken top billing in environmental news this month. On the phone to talk to us about those stories, Great Lakes commentator, journalist Gary Wilson. Welcome back to Current State, Gary.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you with us. Without a doubt, the biggest story of the month was the water crisis in Flint, at least here in Michigan. The state recently approved millions of dollars to switch Flint back to the Detroit water system after water from the Flint River was, of course, shown to be corroding water pipes and leaching lead into people's drinking water. You've been following this issue for a while. What was your reaction to the crisis as it unfolded?
That's right, Mark. You and I have talked about this a couple of times since January. My initial reaction was that of many people that I talked to, which was, how could this happen in the most economically advantaged country in the world here in 2015 and in a state surrounded by, you know, the largest supply of fresh surface water on the earth? We're all familiar with that statistic. And we're talking about safe drinking water in Flint, Michigan, and we're failing to provide it for the citizens of Flint. And my second thought was bewilderment at Michigan's reaction as the crisis unfolded over that considerable period of time. There appeared to be no sense of urgency or recognition of the seriousness of the issue. Flint's water quality problems had become a national story covered by the New York Times in late winter of this year. But then Governor Snyder's emergency manager, Jerry Ambrose, at the time, was more focused on economics and was quoted in the Times story, and I'm quoting here, "To me, the conversation we need to be having is, how do we lower the rates? With public safety in play," that was a curious response. It jumped off the page for me.
The state had initially assured residents that there was no indication that there was any health risk from the water, but research by a local pediatrician showed significantly elevated levels of lead in children's blood there. There's been question about whether or not the state might be on the line for damages. You looked into the legal implications of this situation. What did you find?
That's right, Mark. I talked to Nick Schreck, who directs Wayne State University's Environmental Law Center in Detroit, about the potential legal ramifications and liabilities, if any. Schreck told me that the Flint water issue is, and I'm quoting here, a public health disaster, and the handling of it will certainly receive legal scrutiny by any number of people. What Nick Schreck did say was that, in general, government officials are immune from citizens' suits, but there are exceptions. Citizens and lawyers wanting to sue will be looking for evidence that Flint and Michigan officials ignored warning signs. Did the mistakes they made, and they have admitted to them, equate to negligence? And that's part of the test. If that's the case, citizens may have a basis for a legal remedy. Schreck said, because it's lead poisoning, which has a direct impact on public health over a long period of time, he wouldn't be surprised to see a class action suit in the future.
Has the Flint situation sparked a broader discussion about water infrastructure?
It has. Michigan State economist Eric Scorsone told Atlantic Magazine that Flint's problem is a common problem nationally. He said, as a society, in this article, he said, we've neglected infrastructure and maintenance needs. And that's no surprise. All you have to do is think Michigan's roads.
We're talking with about October's biggest environmental stories with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson. It's Current State's Great Lakes Month in Review. Have environmental groups been weighing on this topic at all?
Environmental groups, not a whole lot, Mark. It just hasn't, these types of issues haven't been at the top of their radar. Sierra Club has been involved in some environmental justice issues in the Detroit area, especially, but there hasn't been a whole lot of environmental group activity in Flint.
There's been specific concerns about water infrastructure when it comes to schools as well. Could you revisit that with us here? Why is that?
Well, the Detroit News reported 2 days ago that there's a gap between the state and schools, with each relying on the other to raise the red flag about these problems. School officials have been assuming that if the water comes through the pipe, it's safe. State officials say they don't test in schools unless alerted to a problem by a specific school. That's a gap that needs to be addressed. If any good can come from this Flint crisis, Mark, it's hopefully, and I tend to be a skeptic about this until I see the proof, that honest discussions on these life-threatening problems can take place with the sense of urgency that they deserve. You know, the Great Lakes region has had two drinking water crises in the last 2 years, Toledo in 2014 and now Flint. I think it's time for some soul-searching on what we value and how we want to be perceived. We need to be positioning ourselves as more progressive and forward-looking, than otherwise we're going to be perceived as being stuck in the Rust Belt era.
The big news from Canada this month was the election of Liberal Party candidate Justin Trudeau to the position of Prime Minister. Environmental groups in Canada had been extremely critical of the current Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. How do they feel about Trudeau?
Well, they feel better. There's an overall sense of relief and cautious optimism. Relations between outgoing Prime Minister Harper and environmental groups were combative at best and, you know, non-existent at worst. With Trudeau, the groups have been promised access and dialogue, and that his new government is willing to work with them, whether they always agree or not. So they're looking forward to the relationship.
Has Trudeau himself given any indication of what his stance on environmental issues might look like? I mean, was the environment a significant part of his platform?
No, and it never is, and that's not a surprise. And in these high-profile elections, people just don't lead with environmental issues. But, you know, and Trudeau has been a supporter of the Keystone XL pipeline, cautioning that he tends to do it in an environmentally safe way if it comes to be. He did commit to restoring financial investment in scientific research, and that was an area that had been cut by the Harper administration. And I have to say that while Trudeau understands the current need for fossil fuels, he's also of a generation. He's only 43, pretty young to be the prime minister of a big country like Canada. He understands the need to invest in renewable energy sources as we go forward. So people are generally optimistic.
The United States, of course, shares the Great Lakes with Canada. Does Trudeau's election have any implications for water policy in the Great Lakes Basin?
I think it can. You know, one area where Great Lakes activists in the U.S. have been frustrated with Canada is the lack of financial investment in Great Lakes restoration. The Obama administration, as we've talked about here many times, has invested almost $2 billion in the lakes since 2009. But there's been no reciprocity from Canada, even though, as you said, in the lakes are a shared resource. So activists are hoping for a change of course there from Trudeau. Now, when it comes to money, that's always a heated discussion, no matter which side of the border you're on. So we'll have to see how the young prime minister does.
Gary Wilson is our guest. It's Current State's Great Lakes Month in Review. Environmentalists in Ontario and some here in Michigan and the United States have been quite critical of a proposed nuclear waste dump near Lake Huron, as have our two Michigan senators, Gary Peters and Debbie Stabenow. Will Trudeau's election have any impact on the fate of that project?
Well, that's to be determined. The decision on that was pushed back until after the election, and the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest environmental organization, is reporting that that decision was pushed back until December. The Council of Canadians is reporting that Trudeau plans to have his environment minister in place by early November. So what does that signal? I don't know. It's hard to read the tea leaves, but I suspect it means that the issue is on its radar. And you have to know that environmental groups on both sides of the borders, above the border, plus politicians will be, you know, making their case to Prime Minister Trudeau.
Finally, a water quality issue that continues to be a rallying call for environmentalists on this side of the border, the algae blooms in Lake Erie. Environmentalists want to force state action when it comes to limiting the amount of runoff reaching the lake. How are they planning to do that?
Well, they've called on the U.S. EPA to declare Lake Erie impaired. Impaired is an official designation under the Clean Water Act, and once a body of water like Lake Erie, in this case, is declared impaired, it would require Ohio and the U.S. EPA to set measurable limits on the amount of algae-causing phosphorus that the lake can take. So it would be a big move.
Gary Wilson is an environmental journalist and commentator who focuses on the Great Lakes. Once a month, we check in with him on current state's Great Lakes Month in Review. Thanks, Gary. Take care.
Thank you, Mark.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. The iron ore of northern Michigan has fueled industrial development in the U.S. and beyond for more than a century and a half. The mighty ships that transport iron ore today are 1,000 feet long and can hold nearly 60,000 tons of ore pellets. It takes many skilled workers to build these ships and keep them seaworthy. From 1979 to 1985, photographer Jim Brozek worked the repair docks of Milwaukee Harbor's Jones Island with camera at the ready. Working alongside the crews, Brozek was able to capture these men and their work in candid and dramatic ways. Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters is the multimedia exhibit currently at the MSU Museum. Peter Worf met with curator and MSU School of Human Resources and Labor Relations Associate Professor John Beck to take a quick tour and discuss Brozek's powerful photos.
Jim, for a number of years, from the late 70s into the mid-80s, would work in a variety of different settings and would take his camera with him. So he was both a worker, but also a worker photographer. So he worked on the repair of lake boats during the winter season in Milwaukee Harbor on Jones Island. And he was working side by side with other boat repairmen. And he would, in this exhibit, you'll see pictures of his co-workers. You'll see pictures of them working on the ships. And many of those workers are just dwarfed by these gigantic ore boats that they're welding, they're doing various kinds of refinishing work on the hull. And they really are just captivating black and white photographs by Brozek.
There are about two dozen of them. Can we look at a couple of them now that we were looking at and commenting on a little bit earlier? I think you called this one here one of the first that you see when you walk into the exhibit, cathedral-like.
Well, what I find the scale of many of these photographs, because of the fact that when you think of the great kind of architecture that we're used to, whether it be cathedrals or other kinds of buildings, lake boats in their same way have that same majesty. This one, which is called Behemoths, really is of two parked side by side, and you have the workers walking on the ice between them. The one over here is an interior shot that actually is almost religious in its own way, with this one ray of light coming down into the hold of the ship where a worker is working. And it just it gives you a kind of a sense both of activity and of work, but also of relative calm and a kind of an interaction with the elements. I think Brozek's work is interesting because a lot of it is really focused on his co-workers often being playful with each other on the job. And yet so much of it is also about what I would really think of as the ability of a photographer to capture wonderful lines and angles and everything else. He has a great eye, and I think that the fact that they're all black and whites, I think, really adds to the dramatic effect of this.
I'm speaking with John Beck here at the MSU Museum. We're looking at the exhibit, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters. Can we take apart sunlight here just a little bit? I'm not a photographer at all, but there's a breadth and depth to sunlight here that, a height and a length that is almost cathedral-like, beams suggesting columns here. There's almost kind of a nave-like quality to the inside of the ship. And then, as you said, you have sunlight streaming down from up above like you would in a cathedral. It has that scale almost.
None of us, for the most part, unless you're in the shoes of a man like James Brozek, is going to be spending time inside the hull, inside the hold, where normally it would be full of, in this case, say, taconite or iron ore. And in that way, it's a glimpse into a world that we cannot see, that chances are we will never experience. But through his experienced eye, we get both that look into that, but we also get what you're really, I think, bringing up, which is it has a certain metaphoric quality so that we can understand things this is like other things that we might know, so that we can kind of project onto it that cathedral quality and other things.
Right. From that large scale to the very human scale, and you mentioned the camaraderie between Jim Brozek and his workers, there's a really just a funny goofing around shot here with him and some of his coworkers, his buddies.
There's actually a number of goofing around shots, and this one, which is think safety, you have a worker who seems to about to be in effect hit with a grinder,
right,
on his helmet, and he's wide-eyed at the prospect. The beautiful thing about this is it does show that camaraderie. I mean, the one thing that people on the job, they have to really depend on each other in terms of the sharing of responsibility for safety, the sharing of skills, the sharing of work, of actual labor on the job, that they're able to make sure that they're working together so that the work goes along well. And it's how are you going to get through the day? Sometimes it's with that humor, but it's always going to be about that camaraderie.
But there's immensity and power going on here. There's some fun and playfulness. There's always, in some of these images, danger and grime going on too.
Well, by its very nature, ore boats are not exactly what one would think of as clean environments. So as these guys are working on them in winter repair, you're still going to have a good amount of ore dust. You're still going to have a good amount of grease and everything else that comes with the territory. But the interesting thing is that we're trying to reflect in this exhibit the broad scale of the kinds of occupations all taken together that have kind of the responsibility and the impact on our ability to actually ship iron ore across the Great Lakes and, frankly, out into the oceans. So that the iron ore really starts in the mines, it goes through the loading docks, it is on the ships with the sailors. Ultimately, all of those waterfront communities not only have the actual ore handlers at either end of the, both putting it in and taking it back out, but all the different shopkeepers, all the other people who have been part and parcel of, frankly, keeping this industry going. And to a great degree, we really want this exhibit to be in homage to all of those different workers that are somewhere along the chain of making it possible to have an iron ore trade here in the Great Lakes.
John Beck at the MSU Museum with Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters, right now at the MSU Museum. John, thanks a lot.
Great, thank you. Thank you for coming, and I look forward to having everybody in the gallery.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our program for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the Lemelson MIT program awards a $10,000 grant to high school teams that invent technological solutions to real-world problems. This year, 14 schools across the country received grants, including two from Michigan. In fact, they're practically neighbors here in Ingham County. Current State's Kevin Lavery meets the innovative minds from Williamston and Stockbridge who are building the products of tomorrow. Plus, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. This week, our Neighbors in Action interview showcases the organization End Violent Encounters, or EVE. We'll speak with Executive Director Aaron Roberts and Advocacy Team Supervisor Wendy Sterling about the services EVE has provided to Ingham County since 1977. Also, John Austin of the State Board of Education on tomorrow's program. The executive producer is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. Get Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every day. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. Find us on Twitter at KAR Current State, on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.